Sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato Sammasambuddhassa. So we just sit for a moment and image your eyes are open, you're looking in front of yourself, you're relaxed, your spine is fairly straight, and you just image a gold light right above your head, about fingertip to elbow above your head, shining down on you. Now there's another one shining from under the floor, shines through walls and floors and cushions, no problem. And one in front of you. And put your mind, feel your mind behind you, and feel one behind you, like the sun shining on your back when you're lying on the beach. One to the right. One to the left. And the four quarters, each of the diagonals. All the lights join up. Then as if we were sitting in a circle in the middle of us, there's this very beautiful kind of gold light, or maybe it's kind of blue. It's a very beautiful light. Just image the name. Jamie. And just image the name Jamie, and just image this energy of gold light around you. Don't think anything more than that. Other thoughts may come and go, but you just image holding that name in gold light. And all other beings who are suffering from physical pain, just let the light move out from him to all beings all over the world, animals, people, all beings. Matan Quince. Have a sense. May you be happy. You did this life well. You did this life well. May you go in peacefulness and happiness. We're grateful that you were here. You did this life well. May you go in peacefulness and happiness. Just image a light opening above the blue light. I have a sense of allowing that to pass that way. You did this life well. This life well, may you go in happiness. I did this life well. May you go in happiness. all of Matan Quince's family. Have a sense of them being able to be present in their grief and not get lost in it, so that they don't lose the beauty of their time with Metta. Image them surrounded by the gold light. Beings on the planet who are suffering loss, extend the light out. Bring the light back to the central light. Bring the central light back, let it dissolve, and let the energy of it come back into your head. May there be happiness. Thank you. It's a mandala.
Four dimensions.
Don't amaryllis do that sometimes? Have four flowers? Well, thank you very much. That was a really excellent class. I'm glad you were. So, do you have any questions? That was good, Wayne. I liked your face. You want to sit up here? There's lots of space, yeah, and I'm in a fairly good mood.
Oh, you are? Yeah.
It could change, as you know. But
I was checking for any weapons there.
No, I'm not going to throw my book.
Okay, well,
that's the only, and I'm going to drink my tea.
You will, okay.
I do have this.
Yeah, well, there's water there. Been around the block a few times.
Yes, you have. Yeah. Yes, you have. Yeah. I think I recall seeing you once or twice as I was going around the block a few times, too. A bigger one, yeah. Do you want a bigger mat under your feet?
No, I just need like a hard pillow.
A higher pillow?
Yeah, over here.
Oh, this one?
Then? No.
Two?
This.
You okay?
Yeah.
You can all sit with your feet on the ground and your knees hanging.
Sure.
You know, I don't care how you sit tonight. I'm very democratic. There's a countdown. Today's the 14th, isn't it? Is today the 50s?
Yes.
Oh, 15 more days to go. I haven't had so many phone calls of a day for a very long time. It's very strange. I haven't had so many people mad at me for a very long time either. Not since the conference of the Dharma Center. I had so many people mad at me. Three people have stopped speaking to me. Because I'm running away. It isn't that they talk to me a lot, it's that they know they can. I'm not going to be there. Mommy's leaving home. Who's going to do the dishes? Right? I mean, probably everybody feels just like me, you know. Geez, I'm really glad I'm going into retreat. Geez, I'm going to miss you guys. Could you come by for tea? Right? Do you feel that way? Or some of you are just glad to see the end of me for a while, aren't you?
Mm.
Must be nice to know you're not alone. It's a common enough occurrence, isn't it? Because we have a very profound relationship, don't we? And so it's nice for you to find out that it doesn't change just because you don't see my body. Probably it will get better. Like I said, I can't talk back as well. So this is the eighth sutras. Everybody have a text? Or a sharing one? More in the back? And like I said, this is a real bone cruncher, but it's quite wonderful. And it's quite wonderful. This one and the next one are two that I've read and reread and reread. Next one and this one, thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jetta's Grove, Anathapindika's park. So what does that mean, that they've said that? What does that mean when a sutra starts, thus have I heard?
That's from the first council. Agreed that that's what he said.
Yeah, that's from the first council. It means that everybody agreed, or the majority, or probably a very large majority of all of the people after the Buddha died, they all got together and they agreed that they had all heard him say this. Because it wasn't a written teaching. It was an oral teaching, so they all memorized. It wasn't until the teaching was, the Buddha's teaching was written in Sanskrit that it was a written teaching, right? So this, thus have I heard, means this is part of the hearing thing, the hearing part, and everybody agreed that's true. And it's probably Ananda who's doing the talking, but not necessarily, because Ananda had perfect recall. And he was at pretty well all the sutras. He was the Buddha's cousin and just liked hanging around him because he enjoyed the bliss state. So every time the Buddha opened his mouth, Ananda was at his elbow. So quite often, Ananda, his cousin, is who's talking here. Thus have I heard, on one occasion, the Blessed One, that means the Buddha, was living at Sawati in Jetta's Grove. So this was at Sawati is either a province or a township. In Jetta's Grove is a particular location, like an address. Anathapindika's Park, and that's the name of the person who would have bestowed it. This was a particular park, as if I recall correctly, that was offered to the Buddha as a place to come and do retreats and stuff. Mm-hmm. Then when it was evening, the Venerable Mahakunda rose from meditation and went to the Blessed One. So he was just sitting there with all the guys, you know, and he did that like day after day. And at a certain time, bhikkhus were welcome and nuns and lay people were welcome to come and ask questions. So they would come and they would bow and they would sit down. They would pay homage in the particular way that was the fashion at that time. Now I suppose you'd take a Starbucks coffee or something, I'm not sure. But at that time, there was another way of doing it, right? So they would perform their necessary act of, honoring this being. And then they would sit down and wait. And then the Buddha would acknowledge that it was okay. He would nod or, you know, wink his third eye or something would happen. And then they would say, see, I'm in a good mood tonight. Do you feel better?
Yes. Much more secure.
Venerable Sir, to the Buddha, various views arise in the world, associated either with doctrines of a self or with doctrines about the world. Is this true? Are there various views about what the self is? Are there various views about what the world is? Okay. Now, does the abandoning and relinquishing of those views come about in a bhikkhu in a monk, in a meditator, who is attending only to the beginning of meditative practice? Is this something that happens quickly? Abandoning these views? So you get the feeling that Kunda isn't necessarily only asking this question for himself. He's probably living with a bunch of two-week arahats. You know, if you go to almost any Dharma center, any meditation center, you always find a bunch of people who are ready to tell you how to do everything because they're awakened. Have you noticed that? And then all the people that you believe must be awakened because they don't say anything. Right? There's this whole group of people, right? And if you spend any time with any group, you find out they're no different than any other group at a sale at Walmart. Or right? Because we're all human beings. And some of us have a sense that I may be a human being, I may be subject to greed, I may be subject to anger, I may be subject to some very wild views, and I know that there's got to be something other than these states. And that's what makes someone want to meditate or practice a spiritual path, right? Mm-hmm. So it isn't that any of the rest of the activity is any different than we all feel all the time, old or young, you know, whatever. So here he is talking about some people who have had some experiences that are more profound than their ordinary experiences as Zellers. A little more profound. They're a little more off the wall. And so they have decided they're enlightened. So this is really nice. This is the Buddha going to lay down what it means to be enlightened and how you can tell. You know, so next time you're, you know, on the net looking for a guru, you've got, after this sutra, you got the criteria. You can just hold this book on your lap and flip through as you're, you know, as you're surfing, right? Isn't this nice? Aren't you glad to have this? Just laid on, freely given. Sort of like learning how to tell a ripe tomato at the market, you know? Learning how to tell a ripe meditator. You can save a lot of trouble with this. Kunda, as to those various views that arise in the world, associated either with doctrines of a self or with doctrines about the world, if the object in relation to which these views arise, okay, if the object in relation to which those views arise, and so then there is somebody who is sitting there, and then something catches their eye, or catches their hearing, or catches their mind's eye, and an image arises. That's the object, right? Which they underlie. And if that object starts to stabilize and feels like, gee, that could be true, you know, begins to be an inkling of, oh, I got something here, right? And which they are exercised upon, and that means you start walking on it. You start acting on that view. Right? So there is an arising of a view, then the view gets more solid, and then you start acting on it. So here he's talking about the three stages of that. Neat, huh? Because you know, you've all of us, when we're sitting or when we're doing any moment of quietness and listening to music or anything, we'll get some insight or some image, right? And then maybe we'll go back and catch it again. We'll underlie ourselves with it, right? And then after a while we start exercising it. We tell it to a friend, or we go around saying, oh, well, I've always known that purple is purple, or whatever. True? So he's talking about three very specific and which they are if any view arises and it is seen as it actually is, with proper wisdom, thus, this is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Then the abandoning and relinquishing of those views comes about. Then you're not going to be stuck in a brand name. Isn't that lovely? If you think you know something, you don't know something. If you think you know what you are not, you're probably on the right track. If you're calling yourself any kind of name, good, bad, up, down, in, or out, you're not on the right track. If it's all a mystery, if you're imminently present with your mind open, not blocked, making yourself safe with answers, then you're on the right track. It is possible here, Kunda, that quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, so this is, you understand those two criteria? Secluded from sensual pleasures, you know, not using a lot of crack cocaine, for example, would be one example. Right? So then that's on the high end of the scale, and just take it down so that your senses are actually just not being continuously stimulated by sounds, smells, touch. You know, you're sitting in nature somewhere, not in a busyness, right? As if a forest weren't busy, but we won't go there. Secluded from unwholesome states. Practicing the 10 marks of Sila. You remember that one? That little write-up? You remember that one? Some of you do, some of you don't. Any of you have never seen it before? Yeah, but you weren't here. I understand that. The rest of you all know it? You know what I'm referring to, do you? Who doesn't know what I'm referring to? You don't? Who else? You remember 10 marks of Sila, Pat? You're not sure?
Morality.
Yeah. And that paper I wrote on it. So, you know, if you want a copy of that paper so that you understand what the 10 marks of Sila is, you can ask Pat or Don or Kathy or Bob or Wayne or any of the golden oldies here. Golden. Golden. If they don't have it, they'll direct you to somebody who has it. Right? Secluded from unwholesome states. Why do you want to be secluded from unwholesome states? Because then your mind has confidence. Right? If there is a sense that you've performed something negative, you can't sit still, can you? So if you're going over and over, and you know, there is a very nice kind of teaching about that. It's called the Sevenfold Prayer, and I think it's very useful for Westerners to practice stages three and stages four. I think it's three and four. It could be two and three, but anyway, stage three is confession. You name all the things you did wrong, but you name them. To now, from beginningless time, countless negative actions have been performed. Not by me, do you understand? Countless negative actions have been performed. Does that make sense? Do you think that's true in this world? That there have been countless negative actions? And due to ignorance, due to not knowing what the result of them will be, do you think that's true?
Wow.
Either willful or unwillful ignorance, right? And the seeds of those actions are going to ripen, aren't they? If you break into somebody's house, everybody on the street gets new locks, right? And they walk down the street paranoid, don't they? And then everybody's going to start distrusting everybody. And then you have to live in a community of distrust. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever action you perform, any of us perform of unwholesomeness, and the seeds of that are going to ripen. In our own faces, aren't they? And so I know not just my negative actions, but all the negative actions of all beings are going to ripen in my life. somehow or other, maybe not all in 1 2-week period of time, hopefully, they are going to ripen. And I really do not want to perform negative actions anymore. That's what you say. You become aware that negative actions have been performed, not only by yourself, because doesn't the ego structure, ego clinging, just love to be, if not the best person, then the worst person? Mm-hmm. Don't you just get into that, ladies and gentlemen? Can't you just, when you're in one of those moods, tell everybody exactly why you're the biggest shit in the block? Isn't it true? Isn't there a certain glory in that? Huh? Am I wrong? I am wrong.
No.
Oh, I'm right. You know, and it doesn't go anywhere, but it does require a lot of attention by everybody around you, doesn't it? I want to hear that just a little louder.
Yeah.
It requires a lot of energy, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, when people have really been determined, when your kids really been determined that they're going to be bad, how much energy it takes, right? It requires a lot of support, doesn't it? It's like a black hole. And if somebody has to be right all the time, and they always have to tell them how good they are, they're equal, aren't they? They're just energy consumers, aren't they? So first thing you do is you say, you know, countless unwholesome actions have been performed, and you don't go through a list of what they are. Because that'll just put you right in the old trap, won't it? And then you'll be going around with the whip. What did they used to call those people in the Middle Ages?
Flogging.
Yeah.
Flagellators.
Yeah. With the, you know, and we probably were all there doing that. You know, whoever made me and who. Mm-hmm. I think we've all beaten ourselves fairly well. I don't think that's one we really need to practice this lifetime. You know, I think we've all probably perfected that one. I think we could probably drop it and move on to something a little more career-oriented, you know? Mm-hmm. Don't visit past glories forever, right? I mean, I know we're good at it, but we don't really have to go there. So then you don't list all your own. You just sort of name, I know these have happened. Because you do, don't you? You know that there's been countless unwholesome actions performed by all beings, don't you? Either willfully or unwillfully. Due to ignorance. And with all my heart, I wish not to perform those actions anymore. Is that true? You bet your sweet bippy. With all my heart, I wish not to perform those actions anymore. And then if there's something in particular that's gnawing at you, one thing, thank you, not a list, one thing, you say, in particular, dishonesty. I really, and then whoever you're praying for, praying to, the Buddha, Vajrasattva, whoever, please, Vajrasattva, help me not do that for the next 24 hours. Right? Or maybe you can go 5 minutes if you doubt yourself. Doesn't really matter. You set a limit that you know you can succeed in. Because the point is wholesomeness. Not to prove that you can, you know, you can grovel better than anybody else in the history of existence. Isn't it? The point is to bring the mind to a wholesome state. So you confess, but then you don't stop there. Because you know, you'll keep going back over it, won't you? So step number 4, I think this is just brilliant. By the same token, to now from beginningless time, countless what?
Wholesome
deeds have been performed. Is this true? And again, not myself, not others. Just open that doorway out. We all, by us. I rejoice in and support that wholesomeness. Right? So you're not stuck on either one. You got them both going for yourself, haven't you? Isn't that beautiful? Hmm? Isn't that beautiful? Isn't it? No, you don't think so? You don't see any point in it. Huh?
Unless it's necessary.
Unless it's necessary, okay. So, here, this is what he's talking about. Secluded from unwholesome states. It's not that you there haven't been the unwholesome states performed. It's that you're not stuck in them. I mean, we've all performed them. Show me a perfect person and I'll show you an optometrist that you need to go to. Is this right? Do you know anybody who's perfect other than, you know, Bob or Kathy or Wayne or Otto or Don or Pat or Morris? Or, you know. I could name everybody in this room other than us. We're all perfectly something, aren't we?
Mm-hmm, yes.
And I'm glad. Nice colors, you know. Nice colors we are, aren't we? All the colors, not blah, tan, perfect. Get on with it, Cecil. Some is secluded from unwholesome states. Some bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the first jhana. Jhana means concentration, first state of absorption, being absorbed. That's, if any of you ever seen anything so beautiful that you were absolutely caught by it for a moment?
Mm-hmm.
How many of you I'd like to see a show of hands? Or heard anything so beautiful? Everybody in this room then has experienced first jhana. That's where the mind is absolutely drawn into and just open with interest. Then if you develop the ability to hold that state longer, it's called second jhana, and it becomes a more profound experience. If you hold it even longer, it's called third jhana. Every time you enter into that state of absorption into one-pointedness and manage to bring your mind more and more clearly to it without getting distracted, the mind states of distraction slowly drop away. There are 8 jhanas, or 9 if you use a different system. 8 or 9 jhanas, depending on how you split them up. And they are the same experience, but with a different depth or length of time involved with it. And the last 4, what you do is you change the object to mental. You actually use the object that you're looking at as the mind, so they become very refined. Like meditating on the beauty of the flower and then meditating on the beauty of space around the flower. Your mind becomes more spacious with the space one, right? Mm-hmm. So enters a, so here he's going to go through these and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by, and this is what is in first jhana includes 5 factors: applied thought, sustained thought, rapture or piti, pleasure born of seclusion. He might think thus, because if he has never consciously experienced that before, and there's a state of great bliss that takes over him, I am abiding in effacement. This is it. I've arrived. I've cut off all clinging. Because I feel blissful to a degree I have never felt before, this is it, I'm awakened. That's me, the Buddha. And some of the bliss states are very strong, so you actually can really be sure of that. Very interesting. But it is not these attainments that are called effacement in the Noble One's discipline. These are called pleasant abidings here and now. In the Noble One's discipline. It is possible here that with the stilling of applied and sustained thought, which is a second jhana. There are three factors in. Some bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the second jhana, which has self-confidence and singleness of mind without applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of concentration. He might think thus, I am abiding in effacement. So he experiences a deeper jhana. But these are called pleasant abidings here and now in the Noble One's discipline. It is possible that with the fading away as well of rapture, of piti, when the piti stops, the movement in the body, energy in the body, you don't feel that, that's not present. The mind goes more subtle than that. Some bhikkhu abides in equanimity and mindful and fully aware, still feeling pleasure with the body. He enters upon and abides in the third jhana, on account of which Noble Ones announce, he has a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and is mindful. That's how the third jhana is described. That when you experience third jhana, then you don't get ruffled by traffic tickets or things like that. He has a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and is mindful. That's the state of third jhana, that there is like equanimity and there's mindfulness. He might think thus, I am abiding in effacement, but these are called pleasant abidings here and now in the Noble One's discipline. It is possible here that with the abandoning of pleasure and pain and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, some bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. It has two things, mindfulness and equanimity only. No experience of pleasure or pain or of sukha, mental happiness. He might think thus, I am abiding in effacement, but it is not these attainments that are called effacement in the Noble One's discipline. These are called pleasant abidings here and now in the Noble One's discipline. It is possible here that with the complete surmounting of perceptions of form, so now we're going into the formless jhanas, with the disappearance of perceptions of sensory impact, this is a very beautiful verse, with non-attention to perceptions of diversity, aware that space is infinite. So when the consciousness opens to space and is aware that space is infinite, then consciousness spreads to infinity. But you go in those first steps first. You don't just jump in there. Some bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of infinite space. And then, because there is, in the formless state, there is no sense of self present, especially. And when you come out of a formless jhana, you don't necessarily, they usually happen very quickly in the beginning, like maybe a split second, so you don't even notice. But you're really happy, you're like you're stoned, is what it's like. I can remember looking around in the room, wondering who was burning hash, giggling. But it wasn't quite a hash high. Thus have I heard. I wouldn't want you to think anything that is true. I mean, isn't true. But it is not these attainments that are called effacement in the Noble One's discipline. These are called peaceful abidings. And then he goes through complete surmounting the base of infinite space. Then the object of his attention when he comes out of that then is he becomes curious about the type of consciousness that is present in infinite space. Mm-hmm. So he uses consciousness, the consciousness that was present in infinite space, as the focus point for interest, right? here that by completely surmounting the base of infinite space, aware that consciousness is infinite, some bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of infinite consciousness. He might think thus, I am abiding in effacement, but these are called peaceful abidings in the Noble One's discipline. It is possible here that by completely surmounting the base of infinite consciousness, aware that there is nothing. So now it's like no thingness. No object, no thingness. Some bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of nothing, or no nothingness, or no thingness. He might think thus, I am abiding in effacement. But these are called peaceful abidings in the Noble One's discipline. You can understand how if somebody has these experiences, they may actually think they were an awakened being because they've experienced no thingness. It is possible here that by completely surmounting the base of nothingness, some bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. So in the previous one, the object disappears. This one, the subject disappears. The subtlety goes and goes and goes. So neither perception nor non-perception. He might think thus, I am abiding in effacement, but these attainments are not called effacement in the Noble One's discipline. These are called peaceful abidings. So these are the eight jhanas, the eight states of absorption that it is that your and my mind can be trained to do fairly easily if we have a place that's away in a secluded place and if we have a wholesome state of mind about ourselves. And we all do, but whether we encourage it or not, that's the question. This is all part of a human being's natural talent, like learning to walk, learning to talk, learning to drive a Mack truck. These are all things that we can all do. Okay, a forklift. Good mood.
Yep.
So, now, Chukunda, here effacement should be practiced by you. And so, I think it talks about, what's that, 107?
It's 1182, I think, the page.
107.
Yeah,
1183. There are 44 modes of effacement to be expounded. So now, Kunda, here effacement should be practiced by you. Effacement means to get rid of the face of, the superficial, to get rid of the appearance of, so that you can see what the true existence, seeing things as they are, to see things as they are rather than seeing an appearance and believing that is what is the truth, right? That's what effacement means here. And this is how effacement is practiced. So there are 44 modes of effacement to be expounded. They fall by and large into several fixed sets of doctrinal categories. And so from 2 to 11 that he talks about here, from number 2 to number 11, are the 10 courses of unwholesome and wholesome actions. And you can see what they are. Killing, taking what is not given, unwholesome sexuality, here it says celibacy. You will find that is a little tight of a description. It shouldn't is necessarily celibacy, but unwholesome sexual practices would be more clear. Lying, demonizing, harsh hatchet job speech, dead speech, that like gossip, that doesn't go anywhere or causes a killing of energy. It's called dead speech, gossip, covetousness, anger, wrong views. These are the 10 marks of Sila, basically. Right? Yeah, I told you there was a paper of Asthan. Those are 10 marks. Those are the 10 things that if you do those things as much as you are able, if you practice abstaining from those things, killing, stealing, etc., as much as you are able, you will find your sense of confidence grows. Your sense of joy in your life increases.
That same thing is building merit?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So they're the meritorious.
Yeah.
They are called the... they are very linked to a teaching called the paramis, performing the paramis. The word parami means crossing over. We all have the power to cross out of being caught in suffering to liberation from suffering. We all have the power to make the boat that will cause us to cross. That power, the first step of it, is to actually have confidence in yourself. The word faith in Buddhism is sadha. It doesn't mean exactly faith, it means confidence. Mm-hmm. That is considered to be faith in Buddhism. Confidence is your obligation if you're practicing Buddhism. It is your obligation to create confidence in this life. You didn't make it, did you? You inherited something, didn't you? Where did it start? To your mom and dad? Their moms and dads? Their moms and dads? You got all of humanity pretty soon. You go back far enough. Then what about all the animals that fed them? All the plants that fed them? Right? You know? Do you understand that? Isn't that beautiful? It isn't whether you're doing good. It's that so many beings have done good. You're riding on the crest of a wave. You know, or if you like Newton, if I appear so great, what do you say?
Shoulders
of giants. There you go. If I appear so great, it is because I stand on the shoulders of giants. Well, exactly. You know, so have a little respect for the giants. Stand! Not about you, it's about all that supports you. So many things, don't they? So many things support you, don't they? Never mind the crap. I mean, somebody else, your enemies will take care of reminding you of the crap. You don't have to go there. You have to know when you do it because it causes you to lose confidence. But awareness is different from clinging to the negative, isn't it? Awareness. Oh yeah, geez, I just told a lie. I don't feel good. I don't think I'll do that again. You know, whatever gods may be, kindly help me. You know, let me remember how rotten I feel when I lie. Period. Period. I know it's not dramatic. I understand you have to put half. So this is my vent. I have been getting phone calls. Okay, so the first 10 I'm not going to cover. I'll let you read them on your own, right? Basically, it's the 10 marks of Sila. First one is, others will be cruel. We shall not be cruel here. So to be practicing loving kindness. Others have humphed. Isn't that beautiful? Others will be cruel. Myself a minute ago is one of those others. But now, I don't want to be cruel. Right? So now we're on... Do you want to read them or can you just leave them? We've sort of run through them very quickly. We can leave them. Okay, then the next one, number 12. And 12 to 18 are the last seven factors of the Eightfold Path, wrong and right. The first factor being identical with 11. So 11 overlaps, right? Right view, right thought, right speech, right action. Wrong view, right thought, wrong speech, wrong action. Right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Right? 19 to 20 are sometimes added to the Eightfold Path. Wrong knowledge and wrong deliverance. Wrong knowledge means insight. That's like path and fruition. You know, if you're looking at it from the point of view of the 16 factors of insight, which of course none of you are, so I'll be erudite and wave it in front of you. You can go, oh,
thank you.
That worked pretty good.
16 stages of insight. The last two, they are the stages that the meditator goes through in meditation, in insight meditation, the stages mind goes through. And certain ones, from 1 to 3, usually go back and forth for, you know, quite a while, 20 years or 2 weeks or something. And then, poof, there's a movement, and then you have some experience, and you go from 4 to 11, I think it is. You go back and forth over those ones for quite a while. And then, poof, you got stream entry. You've got moving into the awakened experience. Then you have the experience. Then you have knowing the experience. Then you have back into name and form again, back into Walmart, but with now real knowledge. So those are the last four steps of the 16 stages of insight. And they're useful to know if you do, at a certain point, if you do a lot of meditation. Not so you can figure out where you're at, because you'll be bound to do this one. But to give yourself a sense of being curious about how the mind works. It's just a mind you got here. It's just a miracle. Mind-body conglomerate you got here. And other than what you habitually use it for, it's nice to know what else it could do.
Good point.
Isn't it?
No.
I mean, it could actually be fun, guys. I have a friend at my house right now who has been coming to me to do retreats for 13 years, and this is the first time she said, you know, this is fun. She was real stubborn. She only laughed when my jokes were really bad. Very strange woman.
What was that, 16?
Stages of insight.
Stages.
If you have that small Pali Buddhist dictionary, there's a short little chart in the back of that that gives the 16 stages, but you'll find them all kinds of places. I'm not sure that Goenka's groups really use the 16 stages, but most Burmese meditation teachers do. Any of the Theravada meditation teachers do. I also have some booklets. Oh, I must have about 30 booklets on the 16 stages of insight, and some other booklets. If you want, I'll send them up here so you can have them available for people. I just got all this stuff sitting there. I never think of bringing it, and so, that would be great. Okay. So these ones of wrong knowledge and wrong deliverance would be a knowledge and an experience of that feels like this is really true. Now I've really got the truth. Like a friend once phoned me and said, you should congratulate me. And I said, yeah, okay, congratulations. Why? And he said, I've awakened. Right? That would be what you would call wrong knowledge. So I said to him, well, shouldn't you be congratulating me? Right? Because if you're awakened, then you see Buddha nature everywhere, right? So you should be going around telling everybody, oh, you're looking real good today. Would seem to me. Then shortly after that, he unawakened. 3 or 4 weeks, it wasn't because of my comment, because he just didn't realize that I had very little perception, which is true. Others will be of wrong deliverance. We shall not be of right. We shall be of right deliverance. So deliverance is the experience. So that the experience and deliverance. No, sorry, knowledge is the experience, and deliverance is the knowing that experience. I think it should be, and I'm not sure about that. So let's just. And it says, see Majjhima Nikaya 1.17.34. If you want to put a note in your notebook to look at the Majjhima Nikaya Sutra number 1.17, which is on page 9.34. This is almost like a Bible class, isn't it?
Yes.
Now, if you turn to the Psalms, 1.17 verse 34, it says it has something about that in it. So, probably has a 16. Okay, there is the Eightfold Path.
What page say it was?
Page 939 is where the reference to right knowledge and right deliverance. 1112 footnote. Let's see whether they do anything there. I told you this was a bone cut cruncher. 1112. Oh, footnote number 1112, not page. Okay. The additional two factors possessed by the arahat are right knowledge, which can be identified. Oh, sorry, I was totally wrong. With his reviewing knowledge that he has destroyed all the defilements. So, having had those experiences of insight, and then reviewing all of his knowledge to see whether there is any sense that this is mine, this is what I am, this is myself. See if there is any residual self-grasping or self-clinging left with any of the knowledge of his being, right? That would be right knowledge. He has destroyed all the defilements and right deliverance, which can be identified with his experience of liberation from all defilements. So like the right knowledge is knowing the state of awakening, and right deliverance is feeling the state of awakening. According to the Buddha, two awakenings are necessary, liberation of the heart and liberation of the mind. You don't just go around saying, oh, all life is one. You have to know clearly everything as it is, not as you think it is. So the views have to be liberated of falsity, and the heart has to be liberated of conflictive emotion. Two liberations. This is a very different thing in Buddhism from any other religious path I know, that both the heart and the mind have their liberation. You know yourself, you know people whose hearts are very liberated, but their minds are really caught. We're in very loving states, but if you talk to them, or whose minds are vast, but they can get really irritated by the smallest thing. So this is where the Buddha is talking. How are we doing? Not bad.
Sorry, can I just ask a question?
Absolutely.
When it says wrong livelihood, does that just mean crap dealer? Does that also mean shares in Exxon or Shell? Or
the first level of it is to be able to feel actually good about how you are living. Right? So in some ways, my livelihood is probably the most meritorious livelihood of anybody I know, except other people who live only by the generosity of others. And I don't know whoever may, I am definitely standing on the shoulders of 20 or 30 giants this lifetime. And I really recognize that. And I hope that I am giving a good view from, telling people what it looks like from here and come on up, But then there are many, many times in my life where I have not practiced right livelihood in order to decide, okay, this is right, this is how I want, or to have the world start to support me because I was doing the right things. So right livelihood, the key to it is generosity. The key to it is not trying to keep something for yourself. That's the first level. Another level of of right livelihood means that you get the biggest return for the least effort. Isn't that interesting? That is to say, not a big song and dance. Mm-hmm. Don't ruin the environment to get a piece of paper. Be aware of your impact. It fits very much with kind of some of the Zen sayings about, the wild goose in the sky leaves no tracks. Many years ago, I decided that even though I was traveling around from place to place, it's called hitchhiking, and sleeping in very unusual places, it's called living on the streets, that it would be nice, however I could, to regularly leave every place more beautiful than I found it. So I used to pick up garbage and throw it in garbage bags. And that became a habit. That would be called right livelihood, although where it came to me from or why, I have no idea. And it continues to be one of my habits, When they were going to move me out of the apartment that I was in last year in my brief sojourn in hell there, one of the things I was doing while I was still living there was really cleaning the tile on the kitchen floor, even though I knew it was going to be torn up. Because I wanted to thank that floor for all the support it had given me. And this gave me a one-on-one experience to do that. So it's not a matter of getting back, get the most back. It means more the state of support and beauty you get from things. That's right livelihood. When whatever you do gives back love. Because that's the most you can get anywhere, isn't it? Love sits in your heart a lot more comfortably than the fear that somebody's going to rip you off. Doesn't it? So that's what I would say. Okay. Oh, and then next one is21 to 23 are the last three of the five hindrances. The first two hindrances are identical with 9 and 10. So 9 and 10 should be a belief in an inherent self. Oh, the hindrances, yeah. See, hatred, delusion, right? Okay, Nibbana, is that right? Hindrances. 21 to 23. 21, overcome by sloth and torpor, right. And Wichikicha and Udacha Kukucha. So that's desire. The first hindrance is the desire for an experience other than that which is present. Mm-hmm. Right? Those five. And so 9 and 10 are the first two of the five hindrances. These are the five things that stop you from practicing concentration. So number 21, overcome by sloth and torpor. That's great, eh? Sloth and torpor. We shall be free from sloth and torpor here. Effacement should be practiced. Others will be restless. Usually restlessness follows sloth and torpor. Because you think, oh God, I'm falling asleep. I'm not doing any good here. Why am I trying to meditate? Right? You go from, oh, Jesus. And then the last one, Vichikicha, or skeptical doubt, that's when you get up and you go to the bar down at the corner and say, oh yeah, I used to meditate too. Oh yeah, I used to meditate. Right? Perfectly clear, isn't it, folks? Uh-huh. Others will be doubters. Others will be angry for, okay, now we're on 24 to 33, are 10 of the 16 imperfections that defile the mind. Anger, vengeful, contemptuous, domineering, envious, avaricious, fraudulent, deceitful, obstinate, arrogant, difficult to admonish. Oh, I went past. That's it. Arrogant, right? And now 37 to 43 are the, so these ones from 34, they aren't in any particular set that the Buddha talks about regularly. They're just things that are not effacement. So difficult to admonish, having bad friends, being negligent, being faithless, and then 37 to 43 are the bad qualities. Being faithless, shameless. So faithless is basically to not have the confidence to do your practice even if you don't feel like it. So you don't have to do a good practice. You just have to do a practice. Neat, huh? Whew. I'm off the hook on that one. Shameless. No fear of wrongdoing. Of little learning. Some people want to have great meditations, but they don't want to learn anything about how the mind works. Some people like to learn how the mind works, but they don't want to meditate. Laziness. Unmindful, lacking wisdom, and adhering to their own views. So those are the 44 ways of effacement. And, well, we're going to make it. Inclination of mind. Kunda, I say that even the inclination of mind toward wholesome states is of great benefit. So what should be said of bodily and verbal actions conforming to such a state of mind? So first of all, you see, a lot of you have heard me say generosity begins with the mind. All karma, all action begins with the mind. First is the arising of an idea, then is the underlying of it, where you start talking about it or having dreams about it, and then there is walking on it, there is the movement of it. And it's the same in Christianity. Seek and ye shall find. You're looking and then something arises. Ask and it shall be given. So you start talking about it and thinking about it. Knock and the door shall open. Then you actually act on it and it happens. right? You'll find in all religions, those three are stated as the way to perform something. You ask for something three times. That means you have to have thought about it, you have to have talked about it, and then it comes out your mouth. Then you offer it up and you wait. It'll come. Maybe not the time you want it to. It's not the point. Don't distract yourself with other things. Get on with your life and keep your thought open. Even the inclination of mind toward wholesome states is of great benefit. So what should be said of bodily and verbal acts conforming to it? So those are the three types of asking, right? Body, speech, and mind. Therefore, Kunda, mind should be inclined thus. Others will be cruel. We shall not be cruel here. You start with the thought. Others will kill. And then it go through right to 43. And then to 44, it ends, right? Others, right to the list we just did, right? They start in your mind, he says. Don't worry about whether you perform it. You start in your mind. You train yourself to think, yeah, that's what I want to do. Not, oh my God, look what I've done, but yeah, that's what I want to do. Confession, okay, but then rejoicing in that there is a path you can follow. Avoidance. Now we're on page 128, right? Because this is just going through that whole list that we did. Kunda, suppose there were an uneven path and another even path by which to avoid it, like duh. And suppose there were an uneven ford and another even ford, and this isn't a car, this is like a way across the stream. I just thought some of you might want to know that because you're very urban. It's a good thing I'm in a good mood, isn't it? By which to avoid it. A person given to cruelty has non-cruelty by which to avoid it. He's saying to you here, it's a choice. And you don't make the choice unless you start making it mentally. He's saying, you got the power. He said, hey, yo, do it. Think about it. Start there. One given to killing living beings has abstention from killing living beings by which to avoid it. Isn't that true? Mm-hmm. If you are given to killing human living beings, and then you notice, but I don't kill living beings all the time, right? Then you know that you can do both, don't you? So then you can practice maybe just a little bit more. Remember, what was the name of that movie? About the German fellow who, Schindler's List, where he was saying to the guy, you also have the power not to kill. Right. He must have been a Buddhist. That's a very Buddhist thought. Mm-hmm. Real power is knowing you have the power of life and death and not using it. I mean, that's good, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Skillfully. Real power is knowing you have the power of life and death over your wholesome or unwholesome mind states. And making a choice for wholesome. Isn't it? One given to taking what is not given has abstention from taking what is not given by which to avoid it. Given to be uncelibate has celibacy by which to avoid it. Given to false speech is abstention. Notice it doesn't say the rule is what will stop you. But it's that you have the choice in every moment. So it isn't like you have to do this right. It's saying if you keep your awareness on the choice, it's more likely that you will choose the even road than the uneven road. The easily traversed ford to the uneasily traversed ford, right? Because don't all beings desire pleasure? Mm-hmm. As far as I know. And so forth, right through the list. to negligence, faithlessness, shamelessness, fearlessness, little learning, great learning, laziness, unmindfulness. We're on page 130 now. When given to lack of wisdom, has the acquisition of wisdom by which to avoid it. Number one acquisition that you have when you realize that there is choice is that you're not a fixed thing. That it's not meant to be, or you weren't made a certain way. It ain't true. You might wish you never had to be aware, because maybe it's safe being totally habitual, making everybody walk around you all the time. But hey, yo, it's not true. That's a lot more fun if you drop it. And so it ends on page 130. One given to adhere to his own views, who holds on to them tenaciously and relinquishes them with difficulty, has, I think it says somewhere in here, maybe this sutra and I skipped over somewhere, that somebody who has wrong view, even if a Buddha comes and reasons with them, they can't hear. Has non-adherence to his own views, not holding on to them tenaciously and relinquishing them easily, by which to avoid it. That is to say, it's always nice to consider there's something you might want to learn, not that you already got the answer. The way leading upwards. Just as all unwholesome states lead downward, all wholesome states lead upward, so too a person given to cruelty has known cruelty to lead him upward. One given to killing living beings has abstention from killing living beings to lead them upward. And so forth, right to 43, one given, and 44, one given to adhere to his own views, who holds on to them tenaciously and relinquishes them with difficulty, has non-adherence to his own views, not holding on to them tenaciously and relinquishing them easily to lead him upwards. This is where the Polish mudra, for those of you who have been initiated, yeah, is very useful. Now and then, the way of extinguishing. Kunda, that one who is himself sinking in the mud, that one who is himself sinking in the mud should pull out another who is sinking in the mud is impossible. If you're in a pit, if somebody is in a pit, you don't get in the pit to try to pull them out, do you? Because then you're both in the pit and you struggle and you sink deeper into. If you're in quicksand, if somebody is in quicksand, and do you jump into the quicksand to pull them out? Do you?
No.
Why? Oh. Yeah? Rebels. Kunda, that one who is himself sinking in the mud should pull out another who is sinking in the mud is impossible. I love the Buddha's little analogies. Aren't they great? Mm-hmm. That one who is not himself sinking in the mud should pull out another who is sinking in the mud is possible. Get out of the mud before you try to help somebody else. That one who is himself untamed, undisciplined, with defilements, unextinguished, should tame another, discipline him, help extinguish his defilements is impossible. That one who is himself tamed, disciplined with defilements, extinguished, should tame another, discipline him, and help extinguish his defilements is possible. So too, a person given to cruelty has known cruelty by which to extinguish it. So forth, right? Right through to 44. One given to adhere to his own views, who holds on to them tenaciously and relinquishes them with difficulty, has non-adherence to his own views, not holding on to them tenaciously and relinquishing them easily, by which to extinguish it. So really, this is saying you can always be a beginner. That's what this is saying. Let go of what you know. Be willing to be here. Conclusion. So, Kunda, the way of effacement has been taught by me. The way of inclining the mind has been taught by me. You got a choice, you got a choice, you got a choice. The way of avoidance has been taught by me. Don't try to do what you can't do. Take the easy way. Take the clear way. Don't complicate your life. And the way leading upward has been taught by me. Don't try to do what you can't do. Very straightforward, isn't it? Buddhism is very straightforward. The way of extinguishing has been taught by me. I haven't given my analogies very clearly. Please forgive me. You heard the text from the Buddha clearer than you're hearing my analogies, so that's okay. What should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion for them? That I have done for you, Kunda. I have given the way of effacement, the way of inclining the mind, the way of avoidance, the way leading upward, and the way of extinguishing, says the Buddha. What should be done for his disciples out of compassion has been done. So there it is. Isn't that beautiful? There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. There's a nice tree with the nice roots around the bottom. There's some empty huts. Go meditate. Meditate, Kunda. Do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. This is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Mahakunda was satisfied and delighted in the Buddha's words. Questions, answers, comments, complaints?
Unmasking,
yeah. It is. Unmasking. So that one can see things as they are. And a lot of this sutra is the need to be in a state of confidence before one tries to see things as they are. Any judgment made not in a state of confidence is liable to be flawed, isn't it?
You're asking for something.
Yeah. Because if there isn't a state of confidence, then there's insecurity, and so that's going to really flaw what one is making a try for. Isn't it? Does that make sense to all of you? Some of you just don't seem to know. In the first part of the sutra, he talks very much about blissful states. He talks about high states. Being stoned is not awakening. I don't know. And then having established that, then he says, what is? And the first thing that he says is, first develop self-confidence. Without self-confidence, you cannot see things as they are. Is that true? So, basically, you know, what I call equal density is a state of self-confidence, where whatever awareness there is of the inner, there is also that awareness of the outer. Okay?
So what brings one to confidence if they don't have it to begin with?
The paramis, those 10 marks of sila. Those from 2 to 11 in the list. Of the first list, right? So the first, up to page 125, he's talking about the states of jhana, which also build great confidence, but they can also build a mind that is subject to great swings of emotion. Because you can start identifying I am these states and then imagine that other people are disturbing them and that they should be removed from the world because they're not spiritual. I can remember one time at one meditation center that I was associated with that there were three or four people up there on retreat and they sent out a notice that they didn't want anyone else coming because it was disturbing their meditation. So you can imagine what the rest of us did.
You think you're disturbed now.
We weren't quite that cruel, but we talked about it. It did go through the mind training. It never quite went through. It arose. It abided, but we didn't walk on it.
So are the bliss, are the bliss states inevitable, and are they a portion that you go through?
No, some level of concentration is necessary in order to have an experience of effacement, what is called effacement here, mm-hmm. or seeing things as they are. The level of concentration, because you actually have to be here to have the experience. And the jhanas are just different degrees of being able to just be present. Mm-hmm. And the ability to be present is based on you're not being caught by fantasy, past or future, right? And so how do you not be caught by fantasy, past or future? That's by being interested in the present. How can you be interested in the present? That's feeling good about being here. So the basis of having even the amount of concentration necessary to awaken is based on the parami. If you're having problems in your life, probably 99% or your meditation, 99% of the problem is based on it can be eradicated by practicing kindliness, usually to yourself. Because if you feel kindly toward yourself, it will spread out. It goes around. Practice generosity, because that makes you think how generous you are. You know the six givings a day? You know that exercise? Mm-hmm. Six times a day, give something. That is so useful. Whenever you have are subject to doubt, practice six times a day. Name something you're going to give. Watch the giving of it. Right? Okay, my next out-breath, I'm going to give to the plants. Imagine the plants receiving it. Drop it. Two of them can be material. The rest of them should be, okay, I'm going to give a moment of listening to my right ear. What you're doing anyway, but you make it a gift. Is that clear? Then at night, before you go to sleep, review the six things you gave that day. Let's see, I gave da-da, and da-da, and da-da. Don't review where they went, or who did what with them, or whether it was the best gift or the worst gift. That's not the issue. It's like to show that generosity is how you live. In one way or other, we all live by a bowl. Some of us just have a very convoluted way of something getting in the bowl and coming back out. Don't we? So by being more clear about the fact that generosity is inescapable in your life, by being conscious of it, naming your ordinary activities as generosity, you begin to realize how much of what you do is a gift to everything. Every time you breathe out, all the plants go, hallelujah, hallelujah. And if you think that way, don't you think that affects the way you breathe out? First you change your mind, and then everything changes. What was the question? So jhana is like not necessary for liberation. I really advise playing around with it a little bit. It's really worthwhile because it gives a sense of the range of consciousness. And so it gives one more skill in relating to those one loves. It's not necessary. It does what jhana does do is that it changes views. It really helps you let go of fixity. You can have a problem until it's a beautiful day. Whatever. So like that. And the Buddha talked about jhana as like washing the mind. Because just for a moment, the mind is... Namjo Rinpoche, probably it's somewhere, he often quotes the Buddha. So it could also be Shakyamuni Buddha saying, Namjo Rinpoche has often described jhana as letting... that the consciousness is this clear consciousness with these particles of soil floating in it, right? And so it looks like it's murky. And jhana is when you sit still long enough so that this... The dirt sinks, so you actually perceive what a clear mind is like, and talk about pleasure. That's very nice. You start saying, on second thought. But enlightenment is, there is no dirt. So they're very different direction. Insight, and again, I recommend you read Ayakema, Who is the Self, to see how this was a very great teacher whose path was a combination, what's called twice liberated, a combination of jhana and insight in an ace insight teacher. And really good at jhana. How many of you read that book? Yeah. Good book, isn't it?
It's one of the very best.
Yeah. Wonderful. Because so very few people actually teach jhana anymore. I had one meditation teacher when I was my great fortunate time in Thailand. One meditation teacher whose main specialty was jhana. But most teachers, even when I was there during the Vietnam War, kind of like were avoiding jhana. And there is this kind of thing in the Southern School Buddhism that, you know, it's like kind of like you don't want to go there because you'll just get stuck. It's not as real as insight, you know? And so it's so refreshing to balance that view that is pervasive anywhere that there is Southern School Buddhism taught by reading a Southern School teacher whose path was jhana and insight and who did it. And that book, Who is the Self, is from tapes that of talks she gave on a retreat with many of her students. So it's very, you know, here and there, she doesn't quite quote something exactly. By the same token, the liveness of her presence is in the book. And I really recommend it. Those of you who already are rather mystical would find it very interesting. Who is the self? Aya Kama, A-Y-Y-A. K-H-E-M-A.
A-Y-Y-A.
Aya Kama. K-H-E-M-A. Who is the self? She has many books out. That one in particular is working with Jhana and Insight on retreat. And it's a real joy. That book, anybody interested in meditation, I swear that book would be joyful to them. Huh? It's just lovely. You really can find your interest arising in the process of what is mine. And what is it? What is an absorbed state? And how do mind and body interact? The next sutra in this starts going through what is the self. So that's going to be really interesting. Maybe I'll just come down next month, just so. No.
I'll tease you there, huh?
What you need to do is get a pile of rocks down by the Calgary Trail there, and then post a watcher. You know, get one of those video cameras, and if you see the old, dimples coming up the highway there, just start throwing rocks. Just because in case, just I think I just have to come, you know, to just be here when you read that sutra or something, you know? Or maybe it's, I've done enough meditation, I'll just go have tea with y'all. Then I'll go back, okay? I'm going to need you to, mental rocks at least, if not physical. You need a stick to beat me back in. Any other questions?
Go ahead just a bit. Why is it called the Division of Lion's Roar?
Sorry?
That's after the next two. The next section, it's a section called the Division of the Lion's Roar. Two chapters after Red U and yeah. What's if we go on 56? Right here.
156?
Yeah.
Oh, because these are all the sutras.